Hey everyone, I've just captured the full story of the Zika virus scam, and it's a fascinating story. Enjoy. Hey guys, I'm back with Dr. Randy Bock, and we had a discussion a while back on the whole COVID kind of scenarios, and it was a great discussion. And he's an extremely erudite gentleman, highly educated, and a great investigative reporter, it turns out. And a story he wanted to bring to this podcast was a fascinating story around the realities around the Zika virus. And you may have heard a few years ago, I saw it, there was all this talk of Zika and brain inflammation, and it smelled kind of fishy to me, and apparently it is kind of fishy. So, great to see you again, Randall, and looking forward to this story. I do not know the details.
Well, thank you so much, Ivor. I'm honored. You present a great point of view to the populace, and I highly recommend your show, and I've seen it many times. So, it's a funny thing. I started thinking about Zika totally haphazardly, and before COVID was even a thought, I had a little bit of time on my hands, which is a dangerous thing. Back in 2016, when Zika came out as a pandemic in Brazil, there was Zika microcephaly, and I had been awake through most of medical school and had never heard of Zika. So I had let my little Google fingers do the walking. And in 2016, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that caught my attention, and it was about the great discoverer. And I think they probably misattributed a little bit, but it's a woman, a neuropediatrician in Recife. Brazilians pronounce it Recife, but for argument's sake, I'm going to go with kind of the Americanized or English version, Recife, which is Northeast Brazil. And she is one of a family of neuropediatricians. And the article goes on that she had a eureka moment. And her eureka moment was having two twins. They were fraternal. They were actually literally were brothers as well, but non-identical twins come out. And one of them had a small head. And depending where you put the it's a statistical diagnosis, microcephaly. It basically means small head. And so you can have the line wherever you want. But in Brazil, they actually have the line a few different places, different times. Another story. But she saw one baby with microcephaly and the other one perfectly normal. And she had her eureka moment. This is a new infectious disease. And I was like, wait a minute, what's the eureka part? It seemed to me like if you have an infection, it would be right through you. I mean, how could the placenta kind of protect one of the two babies and not the other? And I kind of, chalked it up. So I was looking around, what is Zika? What's this microcephaly thing? How bad is it? And it's hard to get, data in real time, as we've seen during coronavirus. It's hard to get factual data. So I just wrote a little thing on Facebook, like, like a one liner, something like that. This seems strange or whatever, because Zika, it turns out, is, I brought my props with me, Ivor. This goes with wherever I go. There are four strains of dengue, and they're called 1, 2, 3, and 4. Pretty romantic, imaginative name. And then it turns out this previously hitherto unknown fifth strain is Zika. And they all come from Africa, and dengue had migrated to the Americas. Nobody's really sure, because it might've come over, with slave ships, or it might've been more recently. They had no way of really knowing what a virus was until the 20th century. And in the late 20th century, they had testing for dengue. And dengue is bone break fever. It's kind of like malaria without the continuation. It's temporary. It's a week or 2 weeks of you're feeling, crappy, shaking, chills, and your bones feel like they're going to break. So it's a kind of a notable illness. There are probably a lot of asymptomatic cases as well. But in the last few decades, there are nearly 1 million cases annually of dengue. And they vary between strains 1, 2, 3, and 4. There might be some immunity to one, then 2 pops up. It's a little bit like the flu has a cyclical pattern. It's a little bit like a one-armed bandit with two different rollers, whatever. So there's the flu. We get a different strain every year. We wind up catching it. But in dengue's case, there are only 4. So this little guy here, that's Zika. And basically, genomically, physically, and I don't know what else, epitopically, the way it appears to the antibodies, they're pretty similar. And so there's a lot of crossover reaction between Zika and dengue on either end, as far as identifying one from the other. And as far as your body having an immunity to one crosses over to immunity to the other. So, this just seems strange to me that dengue, which causes, say, a million cases annually in Brazil, and is carried by the exact same mosquito as the Aedes aegypti, and the key word there is the second one, aegypti, Egypt. So the mosquito is well from Africa. Zika is named after the Zika forest in Uganda, which I thought was a deep, dark forest, whatever. It turns out it's like part of suburban Kampala and not a forest at all. It's next to a Catholic school, next to a hospital. It's kind of more like a little park, the Zika forest. And all through these years, decades of Zika's being in Uganda, never caused microcephaly, never caused microcephaly in Africa. And dengue had never caused microcephaly. And so all of a sudden, Zika, which is pretty much the kid sister, the harmless kid sister of the dengue crowd. And when I say harmless, it might affect primates, whatever. But as far as other non-human primates, but as far as humans go, it had never caused a single human illness in its known existence. So it was discovered in 1947 in Uganda. And if you look at the literature until 2007, so that's, let's see, do the math. I don't know. What is that? That's 60 years. It had caused, Grant is my other prop, like a grand total of zero human cases of illness. So there were no case reports. There were no Zika tests in the world at all at the time that this was announced as a problem in Brazil. So in 2007, in the Isle of Yap, you can't make this stuff up. It turns out Yap is near Guam. It's kind of east of the Philippines. The island of Yap, they had cases of dengue. And then some months later, the specimens got shipped over to the U.S. and CDC lab someplace on Atlanta or whatever. They kind of called them back, said, you know, we think that's Zika. So when this was announced, this was like kind of a clarion call, a wake-up call for tropical infectious disease types. They had a new thing on their horizon. They probably were, you know, Googling it a little bit earlier than I was. And actually, you can see Google Trends. You can see these tiny little blips of when, it, you know, 2007 came along. And it was pretty much quiet after that because there were no human illnesses. I once again went back to the quiescent phase of non-existent human illness Zika and associated with nothing else until the mid-2010s. So what happened then? Well, let's kind of get in the mindset of tropical medicine people in Brazil. There's a kind of an essence in medicine, a sensibility to help the poor and help the sick and all that kind of stuff. And those, sometimes those two get conflated. So some people who are poor are sick, some people who are sick are poor, some people who are rich can be sick, and vice versa. But there's Rudolf Virchow, a German 19th century physician, came to prominence, and he brought this kind of the social part into medicine. So he wanted medicine not just to be treating the patient, but he espoused that we should be treating society. We should use medicine as a way of constructing a better society and applying various tenets to help the poor. All sounds great, all well and good. But sometimes the cart goes before the horse if you start to apply diagnoses or misuse those diagnoses to affect some secondary social change. And we've seen this, you know, through what I call the oxymoron of social justice. I mean, I think you have justice and you can be social. You know, I can be social a lot of times and theoretically I can be just, but it's hard to, you know, be a true judge when you're counting somebody's social status instead of the facts of the case. But anyway, I'm not a lawyer. I'm going to leave that aside or a barrister. Anyway, so here we are in Brazil. And there was a group formed literally for the purpose, hard to make this up, though, the purpose of finding a new virus in Latin America, and specifically in Northeast Brazil. Why would somebody want a new virus there? And the reason is to bring social change. They were, you know, we use this word equity now instead of equality. There were equity, you know, deficiencies. The Northeast Brazil, as far as the United States go, and I guess it's similar to the UK, that the South is poor, is wealthier than the North, seemingly, in the UK. But for the United States, the South historically has been darker skinned, poorer, less industrial, hotter, and all that kind of stuff. And Brazil is kind of upside down from that because it's, you know, south of the, you know, on and south of the equator. Those physicians having this Virchow sensibility wanted to find chikungunya. Now, I challenge you to spell that. That's another African virus that has never been seen in the Americas. Zika, African virus, had never been seen in the Americas. Dengue, African virus, which some point had migrated to the Americas. So they wanted, dengue wasn't enough because dengue hadn't been bringing social change. People kind of gotten used to dengue. Dengue is time limited, doesn't have any treatment. You have it, you're miserable, a little bit like the flu before some of the medicines. But if you have it, you're miserable, you get better. That's dengue. And again, nobody wants it and so forth, but you can kind of treat it by having good mosquito netting and mosquito repellent, getting rid of swampy areas, blah, blah, blah. And then you don't get it as much. But chikungunya is one, it doesn't, it's not a horrible illness, not Ebola. It's not, you know, a horrible deadly virus. They kind of wanted this virus to be there to attract attention to poverty, social inequity, all that kind of stuff in the northeast of Brazil. So they called their group Chik V, the mission. Chik, C-H-I-K for chikungunya, and V for virus. And the mission was referring to both senses. They were having a mission. They were mission-driven. They were zealots, and they wanted to find a virus in advance of having any evidence that there was there. There were no cases. There were nobody, you know, having mysterious illnesses, all that kind of stuff. They wanted the virus to be there, and they were hunt for it. And the mission refers to the 1986 movie with Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro. So it was a big budget movie. And long story short, the mission is a Jesuit mission. And they basically are the good guys in the sense, as far as, you know, kind of the Europeans can be good in this scenario. You know, it's kind of modern view of the colonial, you know, takeover, the European colonial takeover of the Americas. And so the Parana Indians are afflicted in this case or grieved. And the European colonials, I think that it's, I'm not sure if it takes place in Paraguay or southern Brazil, whatever, but it's in that area, central South America. And lo and behold, you know, the Europeans are bad. They want to take over the Indian land. Indians are grieved. They go to the Jesuits. The Jesuits have the mission. They have them, but things end horribly. So I'll leave the ending for people who want to watch the movie. And the hero, you know, is the mission. I mean, the Jesuits are the heroes. They go against the European part, and they sympathize with the Indians. And it's a touching movie, and anybody who watches it is going to sympathize with the Indians because it's a horrible tragedy. Anyway, so they are imbued with this sensibility about helping the people. And again, it's kind of got a race class aspect to it, although the doctors in this case are European descendant and whatnot. And they're going to form this group, Chick-fil-A, the mission in the hunt. So I don't know the entire roster of members of this. There's some, I read a book by Denora Denise, and I think it's from the, I can't remember the title, but her name should find a Brazil Zika, I think from the backlands. And she does a narrative of all, basically the personalities behind the Zika microcephaly phenomenon. She's not questioning it at all. She finds them all to be heroic. And they have kind of, you know, an heroic aspect to them, no doubt. They're on the hunt, and they're doing this as a sideline, not being paid. So they kind of have this intrepid discovery aspect to finding chikungunya. And so there's various groups. And lo and behold, chikungunya doesn't cooperate as a virus by showing up. One of the members, I believe peripheral to the group, or possibly in the group, somehow decides that Zika has. And so this is in northeast Brazil, in Bahia, Salvador, in Bahia province, which is nearby. It's a few hundred miles away from Recife. And so basically in Camaçari, which is kind of the industrial suburb of Salvador. Salvador is one of the major cities. And so there's a lot of automobile manufacturing, a lot of deep manufacturing, kind of heavy pollution, whatnot. There's a ward with some uncategorized cases. They're a lot of them positive for dengue. And so these doctors go through this. Actually, it's a tandem, a married couple of Silvia Sardos and Gubbio Suarez Campos. And they're both PhD scientists, researchers at Bahia, University of Bahia in Salvador. And Denota Denise categorizes, they kind of have a garage, you know, kind of, you know, this sounds like unkempt. I don't really know what it was. I haven't seen it. But, you know, they wind up having on the shelf from a Senegalese researcher who had been there some years before, they happened to have a Zika primer to do PCR testing. This was never approved by Anvisa, which is the FDA of Brazil. It hadn't been circulated through any kind of regulatory group, hadn't been verified. And somehow they had had concourse with a Zika guy. And apparently he got the primer from Singapore or something like that. Anyway, this primer has some provenance of its own, but unverified. And they take this and they get, some individual samples of 24 patients on this ward in Camaçari. And they basically have already been diagnosed as mild dengue and allergy cases. And for some reason, they just decide to pull these. And there's no clinical indication. They pull the samples, I don't know how, and they do PCR testing, and they find that a certain number of them show positive for Zika as well. Now, this is kind of a weird thing because, as we'll maybe see in some of the slides, I can pop up, Zika and dengue are nearly indistinguishable. There is a huge algorithm now to discern one from the other on testing because they're so close together, and none of this probably could have been done at the time, and they had already been associated with dengue. Anyway, so they have this finding of Zika. CESAB, which is an acronym for one of these health groups, a governmental health group in Bahia, the B is for Bahia, and S is Saúde, it's like health in Portuguese. Anyway, so they kind of like dispute this. They actually send a report back to Gubbio Soares Campos and Silvia Sardos, couple, and they say, we don't really think this is the thing. Why don't you hold back? We'll try to review this. Maybe we'll get some better, whatever. They had some warnings and so forth. In April 2015, when there's not an emergency at all, Gubbio Soares Campos and wife decide to leak this to the press. So they go to, I believe, O Globo, which is their local branch of the New York Times, big newspaper of Brazil, and they announced that there's a new disease in Brazil. And this is caused, again, if you watch Google Trends, it caused a little blip in Zika, and people start to search Zika, particularly probably in the infectious disease world. Now, he was asked, is there an emergency? What can we do about Zika? He says, well, really nothing, because it hardly causes any symptoms and there's no treatment for it anyway. He said paracetamol, which is basically Tylenol. And he was asked, why did you do this? As well, as a public health emergency for me to do it. I felt I had to announce this. But again, kind of like looking at the Eureka moment earlier, once I was on this case, I was like, that doesn't sound like a rationale. I mean, if you can't distinguish it, if it took him, nobody in the wards noticed anything different. There were no weird spots or people dying. Nothing was happening in the wards. He selectively and electively chose these samples, blood samples. He didn't investigate, he didn't examine any of the patients. And then he announces there's a new virus. It seems to me more the mission and chickpea the mission type of thing than it is anything to help these people in Camaçari or anybody else for that matter. But the wife announces, that all of a sudden, and this is in the Denise book, that they became celebrities, famous overnight. And if you go to Gubbio Soares Campos' own Instagram, I don't know if he has still this up, but I did a screen capture of it, and it's Descubridor de Zika, and in the Americas. So his Instagram, he wound up getting a better post. He wound up in Buenos Aires as a professor. So he moved from Bahia, which again, by their own definition, is kind of the poorer part of Brazil. He winds up in Buenos Aires. And I assume he did that because he wanted to, and he announced himself the discoverer of Zika in the Americas. And so he is a celebrity. The Van der Linden family of neuropediatricians, they're celebrities. And then, they never have to buy a meal. They kind of eat out on these celebrity things. She was the one who helped connect Zika with microcephaly. So anyway, so this is the Zika announcement. And I think the real key part is the leak to the press. This is not how science is done. I mean, maybe publicity is done this way. Maybe Johnny Depp and Amber Heard do things this way to kind of, maybe prejudice the jury or eliminate the possibility of a jury, whatever. There are a lot of people who do, politics by press release, but that's politics by press release. This is not science. Science has to be you know, kind of an adjudicatory process. And frankly, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard had a much more thorough judicial process than Zika did, and/or Zika microcephaly. Any three of those legs of the stool. So, you know, what happened from that? Well, nothing in a way, because he announced it, but there was no big rash, no pun intended, of Zika cases anywhere, which maybe would cause a rash. And that was that. So the whole thing died down. There was another bunch who were a little bit envious of Suarez Campos. And there was a pair of doctors. One is Carlos Brito, and the other is the leader, Kleber Luz. And Brito is from Recife, and he's a general, you know, internist and so forth, but with an interest in epidemiology. And Kleber Luz is the one who was really, he was aggrieved by this. He had sent some samples. He was on the hunt. Once he, I guess, heard that they were finding Zika, he apparently emailed his compadre in Sao Paulo to he sent some samples. He says, find Zika in this. He demanded she do it. And to her credit, she didn't. She announced back, I can't find any. So he kind of didn't quite throw in the white flag, one of those flags. But right on the heels of that, he announced his own finding of autochthonous, which means from the soil, kind of a de novo cases of Zika in the same area. So there was a little bit of rush to, it's like naming a planet or a crater on the moon. You find it, you name it, that gives your, you know, fame, notoriety, whatever. So that's kind of the Zika story. So I'm going to wrap that up.
And just to wrap that, absolutely, and that was done nice and tightly. We know from COVID and all that there's basically a biomedical spook whole industry. There's the pandemic industry and there's the viral contagion industry. And they're all connected massively, obviously, to pharma and all the other people who have interests in pandemics and viral problems. Well,
we're going to come to that. I think you're
true. But it's seething with all of that confluence of interests and essentially conspiracy. So we know that. These guys you've listed so far, do you think they're more just personal profiteers from fame and discovery?
I think it's mixed in. I think that Denise implies that certain of the physicians had kind of a literal or figurative religious zeal about this. And they wanted to do this. This was, you know, the mission, I think, is a key part here. And I think people have done a lot of great and miserable things based on zeal and fervor and having a mission. But for my taste, again, scientifically, I think, you know, you have to let the facts announce your science rather than the science predetermining your quote unquote facts. And so it's a matter of observation.
Just to keep it, though, just the simple split, zeal and inappropriate zeal and personal zeal and religious conviction and all this kind of ideological nonsense drove them largely, but not so much, you think, direct links to pharma and other business-like profiteers.
No, I think this comes down the road. My favorite pundit, Andrew Klavan, steered me to the term conspiracy of interests. So conspiracy, which I always thought meant cons and piracy, both sound bad. It actually means conspiracy. Spiros is to breathe, like spirometer, and respire. So conspire is to breathe with. It's a great term when you think about it. People are close enough, they're breathing each other's air. And that happens now and then. So conspiracy is people breathing together. But conspiracy of interest is something happens. The example, until I come up with a better one, is I'm walking down the street on a hot day. I've got an ice cream cone. I'm kind of licking. Now, the bugs, the insects, the squirrels, not thinking at all about anything. They're doing their business. Now, all of a sudden, it's hot enough that the ice cream falls to the ground. Well, now there's an event that interests ants, flies, squirrels, raccoons, whatever. They're all interested in this all of a sudden. They're going to divvy the spoils up. Whatever, I move on. So the conspiracy, it's not like they predetermined, oh, I want ice cream to fall. None of them had the power to make ice cream fall. And none of them had the agency to do much. But once it happens, things happen. There's an agglomeration and there's an action. So for my taste, the conspiracy of interest happened as time went on. And oddly enough, and macabrely enough, it involved the pivot, political pivot of abortion, because microcephaly became the actionable item to change the remaining strict abortion laws on planet Earth. And I can show you the picture of this, and you can see that the red areas are the places where abortion is illegal, and they tend to coincide with the historically Roman Catholic. Getting back to the mission, the Roman Catholic vestiges and political interest and religious interest in Latin America. So Brazil is, in a sense, and has been called at various times, you know, kind of ground zero for the pro-abortion movement. They want to flip Brazil. It's a bit like our electoral college. You flip, Texas or state, and you're well on your way. So again, this is kind of cutting to the chase a little bit, but as time went on, there was a big political movement almost immediately to flip the laws and have judicial injunctions and allow abortion. The WHO had advisors and in tandem with some of the health ministers within kind of Latin America, just Central America and South America, there were warnings to basically create a birth moratorium, to have stop having children at all until there's a Zika vaccine. This might sound familiar.
Ah, yeah.
And Donald McNeil, the erstwhile New York Times global health expert, chief science writer, actually was pretty much on this bandwagon as well, beating the drum. He literally wrote the book on Zika, and he was the chief reporter and, you know, drumming it up, very similar to, I have an article on Donald McNeil called The Marvelous Mr. McNeil in Brownstone, came out fairly recently. And so he and I have had, a bit of banging heads. He kind of thinks I can fool people because of my medical degree into believing that Zika doesn't cause microcephaly, but I'm going to be preposterously embarrassed and whatnot. And he's been a little bit snide and whatnot, snarky. But I tried to be objective in treating his case. And in both these two cases, and frankly, I think because he got away with so much, drum beating and getting the entire health apparatus. He was best friends. When I say best friends, they had a long history in New York City when Tom Frieden was the public health commissioner of New York City via Mayor Bloomberg and Donald McNeil. There's many, many articles, dozens, if not nearly 100 articles with Tom Frieden in it through Donald McNeil's long tenure at the New York Times. And then he went on to become, he was tapped by Mr. Obama to be the head of the CDC. There you have it. Anyway, so he managed, he had inside communications with Tom Frieden's, himself and or his next of in command, and got him to focus on Zika microcephaly. And this was a big thing. And it's part of the narrative that, global, warming, climate change, whatever is going to bring these tropical illnesses up. So the threat is, I don't think necessarily real, but it's there in their minds. And this is a separate, total separate virus, the virus of mental, idea contagion and whatnot. But the concept is, this is very broadly put throughout the epidemiologic infectious disease community, that these they're next, they're gonna show up on the streets in New York like very soon. And so This was the thing, we have to kind of quash this and get on this and find the vaccine for it. And so we never have this happen to us in New York City and or London, whatever. So anyway, that's kind of cutting to the chase. I with your permission, I want to kind of touch on the second half of the story. Again, for my taste, again, this is a prop. There are three legs of the stool. For this stool to stand up, all three legs have to be firm and sturdy. You take one of the legs away, it's not a stool anymore. It flops over, or a tripod. And so the first leg is Zika, which had never been seen in the Americas at all and never caused a single human illness at all, was in the Americas and was doing that. Okay, that's part one. That's the Zika story, and it was leaked to the press. Boom. Part two is microcephaly epidemic. What's going on with that? So this is in Recife, Brazil. It's a city. The metro area is about 2.5 million people. If you do the stats based on the cutoff, where you determine what is microcephaly. Now, microcephaly, it's again, it's like, Who's short? You can't quite say, one of the words for short people, but, who's technically clinically short? Well, it depends where you draw the line. Like you know, like a short person in the United States can go to Japan and not be a short person anymore. And so, you know, these things vary, and it's almost the same kind of thing because smaller head babies can come from smaller people as well. So in Brazil, the Indios, as they are called, you know, the Amazonian tribal cohort, they're shorter than the European Brazilians. And so there's a full, I forget, it's almost like 2 centimeter difference on average, or maybe even more, between southern and northern Brazil. There's more prematurity in birth in poorer areas. And anyway, so in Recife, at the time, there and throughout Brazil, there was no registry, there was no prior data collection of small heads, microcephaly. So when you say there's more of something, you have to always say more than what. Like if the rainfall, it turns out we've had, I don't know, 3 inches of rain this month or this year. I'm like, well, I don't know, is that a lot or a little? You know, we look back, say, oh, well, last year it was 2.4. Okay, fine, is more. How much more is it? But if you don't have a backlog, literally a log of back data, you can't figure out if something's more or not. Anyway, so this is where the Vanderlyn family came in. They weren't the only ones. There are other neuropediatricians. So this mother daughter, Anna Vanderlyn, and she was married to the late neuropediatrician Vanderlyn, and one of their sons, Elio Vanderlyn, also neuropediatrician. Anyway, they neuropediatricians in their blood, and Vanessa. And so in Recife, Vanessa and Anna, doctors Vanessa and Anna, at one point decide that in the wards where ordinarily there would be like 7 within the city cases of microcephaly, now there's like, it's hard to get a firm number from their reports, but maybe like 13 to 15 at one time. And so they have their own WhatsApp group, like the CHIKV WhatsApp group. They have their own WhatsApp group, and they start communicating what's going on with this, more cases of microcephaly. Now, lo and behold, so anyway, so they had no real way of firmly determining this. And it, even within the statistical flow of something rare, if you have a little bit more, that doesn't necessarily prove an epidemic. It was in one area, it wasn't one town, and it wasn't, they didn't make a call to Brazil's Ministry of Health and try to do a firm study and try to get some data and whatnot. They just kind of announced it. And this word percolated through one of the health ministries locally in Pernambuco, the province. And lo and behold, somebody from part one, if you remember Dr. Carlos Brito, he happens to live in part two in Recife. And he gets called by the health ministry because it sounds like he's a pretty connected guy. And he gets called in and he talks with the Vanderlyn neuropediatrician family and believes it's Zika. He says, this is new, Zika's new, and microcephaly's new. There's like, you know, a certain number of months. This was August of 2015, 4 months or whatever. There's probably enough time for this to percolate through in pregnancy. These babies are a result of Zika in utero. Now, again, dengue had never caused a single case of microcephaly, as anyone could tell, and Zika never caused any illness at all. So Dr. Brito's on the case. So what does he do for science? Does he Zika test the mothers? No, there's no Zika test. They don't exist because Zika has never been an illness.
They could call Drosten to make up some test.
Right. Does he make a prospective study, you know, to kind of look forward, spend the next year, kind of investigate or watch the numbers and develop a database of prior cases so he can look to see if there is an epidemic? Or does he check other regions or compare city by city? No, he apparently gets somewhere around 29 to 30 cases of the mothers with microcephalic babies. So he has a selection bias. He picks these mothers. And then there's authority bias. He calls them up, and whether it's he or one of his minions, you know, and announces where they're from and so forth, and asks each of these mothers, this is the questionnaire apparently, did you have during pregnancy rash, fever, chills, achiness? And this is tropical Brazil, okay? Yeah. It's a swampy, hot place. And to ask any mother, mind you, you know, I don't know, if I ask my wife this for her pregnancy, I'm sure she had an episode of rash, fever, aches, and chills. I give her like an ache almost, you know, every day. I probably give her rashes. So he got a high preponderance of these mothers saying yes, and he said, Zika.
But no control. No random group of 30 asked him the same question. Nothing.
Again, this is from Denise's book. I've sent letters to Dr. Brito and I've not received a response to that.
Of course you didn't get a response, because it's clearly, and I'm hearing this for the first time, and it's literally zero science, zero relevance to anything.
Well, to be fair, he did answer one of my emails with some articles, but I didn't get an answer to that question.
Yeah, of course.
Anyway,
how could you?
So what does he do? Well, apparently he convenes a member, a group of a board meeting of this Pernambuco health, you know, public health grouping with some physicians or whatever in Recife. But the meeting winds up, that group winds up withdrawing, and they don't show up because they're ticked off, they're peeved that he leaked to the press, or excuse me, not he, somehow, somebody, I don't know who, leaked to the press that Zika, this new illness from April 2015, was bringing about these new microcephaly cases from August 2015, and he did that in October 2015, and that, you know, that lit the flame. It did wound up not just being a little doctor's, you know, chat groups, WhatsApp. This wound up being, you know, if you can use this word, kind of a social contagion where people were on the hunt for microcephaly cases. And it wound up being a huge overflow and overdiagnosis of number of cases. How do I know that? Because the actual number of cases was enormous. And when they sifted it all down, you know, it's like panning for gold. You start with a lot of stuff and you wind up, boom, boom, boom. There's really tiny little nuggets, if any. And this is what happened over time. The number of actual cases of microcephaly were minimal. There are a lot of issues with those cases of microcephaly, because microcephaly, I'll give you an example of a virus that causes a congenital problem. So German measles, no offense to the Germans, also called rubella, has a what I call an identity function, which is a one-to-one. This causes this. I'm so happy I brought these props with me. Causes this, and this is only caused by that. So if you have a virus naive, immunogenically naive, first trimester pregnant woman who gets the German measles, she's never had it before, she gets it then, it's nearly 100%, from what we can tell, 100% of the time that baby's going to have congenital rubella syndrome. I don't want to get into it specifically, but it's associated with deafness and some other potential neurologic changes. And apparently it's identifiable to pediatricians, well, not anymore, because, you know, this is one of the excellent viruses out there. People don't get rubella anymore. And so we don't really see this rubella syndrome. So the studies such as they are from the 1960s and whatnot. And conversely, rubella syndrome is only caused by rubella, not seen with anything else, not been associated with anything else. So it's a one-to-one association. Microcephaly, if you go back to the, you know, the before times of Zika, you know, in 2015 or 2009, whatever, you know, microcephaly is, there's no single diagnosis, basically means small head. And so there are severe cases and they're not so severe cases. There's a genetic case of, it's an autosomal recessive case. One out of 10,000 babies are going to come out with what they call true microcephaly, which is the worst kind, you know, very tiny brain. You're not going to be functioning, you know, as an adult in society and so forth. And a lot of them don't make it through childhood and whatnot. So that's severe, true, they call it true, that true micro. So there's a genetic cause, but not congenital. Congenital means you get it during pregnancy. So that's genetic. Then there are a bunch of these mildly associated things. And it goes for the whole gamut of things that are mostly associated with poverty, not all, but, you know,
malnutrition, I guess.
Malnutrition, pollutants, toxins. There's a set of virus or infectious agents called TORCH, toxoplasmosis, rubella, cytomegalovirus, herpes, and syphilis. And those are, some are bacteria, some are amoeba, some are viruses. Anyway, it's a bunch of stuff. And so any number of infectious diseases can cause this. And what else? I don't know. Nobody really knows. Alcohol, drug abuse. So there's also, you know, a lot of it's conflated with small stature, premature babies. So I have a chart that, you know, if you have a small, you know, if you don't know this prematurity, that baby's going to come out with a smaller head based if you put it on the chart above. Also, the growth charts for babies is developed in Brazil from Sao Paulo, which is the European taller people, bigger babies. And moreover, Brazil did not have, again, this is a slide I'll show, did not have the correct standard of diagnosis. So there's the normal Gaussian standard distribution bell curve. And they were using two standard deviations on the low side, which is about 2.1% plus the three standard deviations. So about 2.35% of the population is automatically going to be considered microcephalic according to the Brazil standard at the time. In late 2015, with this flood of overdiagnosis, Brazil itself changed the standard to the Euro and WHO standard of three standard deviations, which is about 0.1% of children has having this automatic diagnosis by statistics. So they were taking away a lot of what we might just call normal but short people if they were on the same thing and finding the actual, you know, true, say, dwarfism, that kind of stuff. If we're making an analogy to height, you know, there are some short people with an actual abnormality and there's some people who are just short. And so in this case, there are a lot of babies with small heads and, you know, they're small and they they're not necessarily associated with cognitive problems per se, but their standard changed in the course of this, but it's almost too late to get the horses back in the barn. And by this time, there was just this massive overdiagnosis and it was happening in a lot of places, frankly, throughout the world. There's this big burst in cases of Zika and this big burst in, you know, announced microcephaly, and it all dies down thereafter. So lo and behold, you know, in 2016, when they still didn't have a Zika test, but they wound up having better standards for what isn't microcephaly, tried to adjust it for height differentials and you know, between the different, you know, ethnicity populations, size of parents and all that kind of stuff. By the time 2016 shows up, they didn't find any microcephaly in Northeast Brazil, any other part of Brazil, and so forth. There's a slide I have from the Washington Post, which is during 2016, that scientists are bewildered. This is not about the fact that it hadn't come back yet, but they were bewildered by the differential between in Zika's path through the Americas. Like Brazil had, at this point, they had announced 2,033 cases of microcephaly, and Colombia, and I don't know if you know this, but apparently mosquitoes can't tell national borders. Now, they're very skilled at certain things, and apparently it's the woman mosquito only that does the biting. The guys are just kind of like, you know, they're not quite sperm donors, but they basically the sperm donors. They're smaller, they have a shorter life. They're there to, you know, help the gal create new mosquitoes, and the gal's a hungry one because she's got the young to feed and whatnot. Anyway, so but even women mosquitoes can't tell the border. And the Aedes aegypti distribution, if you look at a slide of that, you'll see that the Aedes aegypti, you know, kind of tracks with the jungle and whatnot, and it crosses borders in Venezuela and Colombia and whatnot, and those countries did not have any microcephaly. And they didn't have this problem like this. And if you look at a separate slide that just shows the dengue distribution, which should coincide with the Zika distributions, because it's basically the same virus. So basically, you know, there are also these, there's another chart, you know, once the Zika microcephaly industry started, there are all kinds of people coming out of the woodwork to you know, home in on this. And there's one chart that shows the kind of the flow of Zika as it's going to kind of take over Brazil. 2014, just in the Northeast, 2015, 2016, take over all of Brazil and into Colombia, whatnot. But again, the cases and the disease, as it were, or the microcephalic children did not, you know, cooperate. I don't mean that. I mean, it sounds harsh, but basically the facts didn't cooperate with the theory. And this seemingly has not slowed anybody down in the interim. You know, I've got a few slides showing some of the, you know, rationales, you know, the dog ate my homework kind of stuff of what happened. So let me just kind of reiterate. In 2015, this thing happened only in Brazil, and it pretty much only happened in the northeast of Brazil. There were a huge extra number of cases. I've got a slide that'll show the large number of cases compared to verified cases, and that most of it all centers around Pernambuco, which is northeast Brazil, Recife, and the environs, the provinces. This coincides with what you see on Google Trends for people searching the words microcephaly, microcephalia, and searching Zika and so forth. And it's all, you can almost see this thing in Google Trends as it percolates out. And it also kind of shows up in southeast Brazil, but I think that's because they're more news focused. And so in Sao Paulo, whatever, there are cases, whatever, but those turned out to be a lot of factitious cases, a huge exaggeration, because they don't really have the mosquito problem in Sao Paulo that they have in the tropical, warmer, swampier north.
So in a nutshell, it seems to be a classic case of looking too closely with too much zeal and finding something that essentially isn't there. And as you say, the mosquitoes travel across much broader areas. The dengue is seen across much broader areas, validating the fact the mosquitoes are going there. But somehow the Zika only popped up in the area where the zealots wanted it to, but not anywhere else.
Right. And they can't even document the Zika part because they didn't have any Zika tests.
So anyway.
Right. So the Zika test, from what I understand, started to show up in 2017. And there was a kind of a worldwide alert because the WHO, they didn't call it a pandemic technically. Everyone else called it a pandemic. They called it a PHEIC, which is a public health emergency of international concern. Yeah. So they had travel advisories in Brazil. Lots of stuff happened. The erstwhile president, Dilma Rousseff, had already been impeached for other, quasi-corrupt criminal-ish reasons. And so she was on the ropes. Like many politicians, she saw an emergency as a good time to anneal and congeal the population and get them to rally in her favor. She had 250,000 troops on the street, and they were on basically mosquito duty. They were, there's an old joke about, killing a mosquito with a shotgun. I don't know if they actually tried that, but they had, some of it's good, to kind of drain, we wanted to do in Washington, they drain the swamps. So there's certain places, whatever, that's fine. All well and good. And there's an awareness campaign. But, what happened was that people's lives changed. And they still remain changed. It's not as big a deal as COVID, but if you're a young pregnant woman anywhere in the tropics, you're getting advice to stay indoors, to keep wrapped up, to slather on insect repellent daily and whatnot, which has its own problems and so forth.
Yeah.
And nobody has brought about the good news that this never recurred, even in Brazil. It never recurred in Brazil. It never recurred anywhere else. In Rajasthan, India, they were on the ready. In 2018, they had Zika tests. They had the firm standard of what is and what is not microcephaly. And they were ready to go because somebody found Zika in Rajasthan. Okay. Nobody ever found an increase in microcephaly.
Yeah.
So this brought out, it's a different strain of Zika. So dengue has its four strains. So apparently Zika has two major strains itself. And I need an extra finger for that, I guess. So maybe it's the wrong strain. Maybe it was a special strain. Maybe there was super immunity right away from that one, bunch of Zika in 2015, and then nobody has it anymore, and it's going to come back. What I call the locust theory, that somehow it's going to come back in 7 or 8 years. I've been in discussions with Dr. Anna Durbin of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and she is endeavoring and enterprising and continuing with a human challenge trial. Now, what does that mean? It means that you're going to inject people with Zika in order to help find a Zika vaccine. And this segues into the next part of the story, in a sense, because there's a vaccine coming. Now, if we had listened
to
Donald McNeil and his kind of congeners and acolytes from WHO, there would be no children at all in Brazil right now in first grade, because people would have waited these, ongoing, by my watch, nearly 8 years of no vaccine. It's kind of like HIV. If you just waited for a vaccine, you'd be in trouble. Therapeutics have their own issue for, they were the thing for HIV. The Zika vaccine came about, the United States became the engine, a little bit like NATO and a bunch of other things, became the engine, the financial engine for Zika. This was at the pleadings of of Donald McNeil and Tom Frieden, and then our friend Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci, you know, literally, and I think against the law, borrowed, he took money from ongoing diabetes and cancer projects and took those chips and put them on Zika development because he wanted to force the hand of Congress, which had been, you know, in his view, lollygagging over the abortion question. So at the time, there's a Republican Senate and I believe Congress as well. And they were holding off on the Zika appropriations because a lot of it was going to go to Planned Parenthood to promote abortion in Latin America. And so they held off on that. So it wound up being September 2016 that the money, $1 billion, I think I got to go like this, $1 billion was appropriated for Zika. 450, 45% of it was towards a Zika vaccine. And the rest of it went for stuff. I don't know, information. I don't know. I'm not sure what you do exactly. There's no treatment for it and whatnot. Mosquito netting, you know, anything you do for dengue, you can do for Zika. But even by that time, it was facts on the ground, a little bit like Dr. Fauci's ignoring the Diamond Princess, the better data. They seem to only choose the worst case scenarios. So he was choosing 2015 Brazil data where there supposedly was more microcephaly. Again, this panic of numbers before it kind of filtered down and didn't announce that there was nothing going on in Brazil or anywhere else in Latin America in terms of microcephaly bursts, but kept took the money from these other projects, kind of, you know, held Congress's feet to the fire. I don't think necessarily they do a lot of research and whatnot. And they wound up appropriating $1 billion in September at a time when Zika microcephaly had gone. So the hunt for the vaccine went on. The money got filtered through Takeda, Sanofi, and Moderna. And they're hunting and hunting and hunting. Now their problems kind of ran a shoal they couldn't float this boat because there were no more cases of Zika around. Once they had testing, no more cases of microcephaly. So they went back by 2018. I'm going to backtrack slightly. In 2016, 17, right at the cusp of the year, after the money got appropriated, they spent on $1 million on a blue ribbon ethics panel to ask this one question: should we do any human challenge trials on Zika? So the CDC and U.S. government had been burned twice, notably in Guatemala and in Tuskegee, on syphilis experiments and not letting people know that they were already at a certain point there was already treatment for syphilis. So that was deemed a human challenge trial, where it's kind of a anodyne term for letting people get infected and you watch them potentially at their risk. And so they thought about it. They said, no, Zika doesn't deserve this because there is good prophylaxis. And again, they're stipulating that Zika caused microcephaly. We're going to stay on their team for a little bit. So if Zika caused microcephaly, you still don't need to do a human challenge trial and inject people with it because there's a risk if you inject them, they have a problem. And there's no reason to do that because there's good prophylaxis. You know, you stay indoors, you have mosquito netting, blah, blah, blah. You don't need to do that. You can test for Zika. And you don't have to get Zika as a young pregnant woman, and so forth. And they said, there's no reason to do that. So that was the ethics panel recommendation. And that stayed for a while until 2018. I think they still had a few $100 million of this Zika vaccine money. So they went, it's reported it by John Cohn in Science in 2018, that they went to the Americas, mostly Brazil and probably other countries, and said, look, we would want to fund a human challenge trial. And Dr. Fauci, intones on this that, yes, he knows about the ethics panel, but this is more important, to get the vaccine. And so Brazil, through its Anvisa, which is kind of their FDA, they said, thank you, thanks, but no thanks. And this is, and we've already talked about social inequity and poverty in Brazil's Northeast. So knowing that, they still turned this money down. I'm not sure how many millions of dollars would be for the researchers and facilities and whatnot, but it's usually generous. And so they turned it down. And so that was kind of the end of it temporarily. But in 2020, 21, Dr. Durbin made another proposal, because I think she was part of that other one, to do it in the U.S. So as we stand right now, they are injecting, I don't know if they're finished, but for the last year or so, they've been getting women in Baltimore to be injected and infected with Zika, and then watch them. And this is to help kind of finalize the steps on making a Zika vaccine. Now, There already is a dengue vaccine. I think it was developed in 2009, and there's a vaccine called Dengvaxia, and there's another newer one, but that ran into certain problems. And I have been looking at this lately. So in the Philippines in 2015, now before Zika was a thing, so this is not to be conflated with this, it wasn't you know, cause and effect. All spontaneously, there were issues with something called ADE, antibody-dependent enhancement. We've probably seen this term during COVID. And for my taste, and I'd like to write an article on this soon, is why was there never a vaccine produced against SARS-1? You know, like the Great War, World War I, it wasn't called SARS-1, but SARS, 2003 SARS, caused a lot of upheaval in China, and they never wanted it back. There were literal riots in certain towns because of the China's, you know, policies of shunting people and putting them in camps and all kinds of stuff from SARS-1. And so China had every interest in making a vaccine to this, and they worked at it. And there were lots of studies done, and they kind of ran into a brick wall, maybe the one behind you, of not being able to do it because of ADE, antibody-dependent enhancement. That is to say that in the case of SARS, which is coronavirus, probably people had already been exposed to other coronaviruses. And when you give them a piece of that coronavirus, they overreact to it, and they get an enhancement, an antibody-dependent enhancement, and they get too sick, and they get reactions in other ways. So that's ADE, and that's what held back the SARS-1 vaccine and probably should have been a good sentinel, harbinger, warning, lighthouse effect to warn us against just waiting for a SARS-2 vaccine, because there could very well have been issues with that through ADE. So I haven't parsed out all the data and whatnot, but there were warnings. And so this kind of concept, again, always to push the vaccine seems to me a little bit odd. And so it was already known in 2015 that the dengue vaccine caused ADE, and yet people are pushing for the Zika vaccine and don't have children until then and whatnot. This seems to be rather odd. And I mean, I'm going to use the word possessed in the sense of kind of regulatory capture possessed, that who's, you know, qui bono, whose interest is this? Who's benefiting? You know, is it the people benefiting? You know, and again, so there already was a dengue vaccine. Dengue is close enough to Zika. This is, again, not my work. I'm not a researcher. But, you know, early on, people thought in the early days of Zika, the 2016, 2017 era, and up to 2018, they thought there were enough epitopes, there was enough appearance on the outside shell of dengue, and it pretty much overlaps. Again, I love my props. It pretty much overlaps with the identical appearance of Zika, that they could make a vaccine for dengue and would cross-react and prevent Zika. I mean, why not? They are almost identical. Again, you can pop up pictures of them. So I think that brings us to the current day for the most part. I do want to, I guess, mention one other aspect. And I have a slide for this, which shows that when they actually, so somebody actually endeavored to recreate the missing microcephaly registry. So in 2015, when they started seeing these microcephaly cases, they had nothing from which to compare. Okay, fine. So somebody went back and looked at the kind of the clinic population, kind of the poor population, whatever. And they had apparently, because they were state, I don't know, kind of welfare cases, whatever, they had done more measurements, whatever. And they put up a lot of the stuff together. So they got computers and they put the data, and they actually came with the database. And there are levels of microcephaly, as there always will be. And every animal on earth probably produces microcephaly. You don't see microcephalic raccoons, whatnot, because they don't live and they don't nurture their young the way we do and we can. We have civilization which can kind of nurture cases that wouldn't necessarily survive in the wild. But anyway, so they made a database retroactively, and the Zika year, the panic pandemic year, doesn't really show up as much different from those prior.
Yeah.
And so once they get away from the kind of the hothouse environment of Recife, under the gaze and you know, conversation of the neuropediatricians there, they don't really find anything broadly, you know, spoke within Brazil, within Northeast Brazil or Brazil as a whole. So that's kind of the Zika story. I mean, there's a lot to fill in there with data and whatnot, but
I think that's perfect, Randall. And I think the real kind of wrap up of this is always down to the predominant cause or root cause of this issue, or swine flu debacle, or the SARS-1 thing, or I think there was a pertussis scare and they were running for new drugs. And it turned out statistically there was no change at all related to some lady doctor. I didn't look into that one. And of course, COVID. It's the commonality of them all. And you've given a beautiful example there of the issue that was not an issue at all. But yet we had all of this money and all of this vaccine drive. And I think it's quite simple, just to use Occam's razor. What's common to all these things is the power waiting in the background of the pandemic industry, the biosecurity spooks, the WHO, Big Pharma, Fauci, CDC largely taken over, regulatory capture. Put that whole system, and it's like an evolving organism. I was talking to my wife last night about this, but not in the context of Zika. It's an evolving organism over the past many decades, and it's become huge and powerful. And I think the only thing that changes on the individual debacle, the only thing that changes is, have they smelled the ice cream, to your earlier analogy? Have they seen an opportunity to exploit? Or have they actually kind of helped create an opportunity more actively? But that's the only thing you need to check out in any given scenario, okay? At the end of the day, we have a massive organism that has evolved over decades that is there to exploit fear of viruses and utterly magnify impacts. You know what occurs to me, Randall? You said you look back and there isn't really a spike in 15 or 16 when they retrospectively got prior head sizes. Yeah, well, look at COVID. You look at the Swedish data, no lockdown, no masks, and kids up to 16 in school, a perfect country, unprotected by any real measures of note. And you see the spike of excess mortality in April 2020 at the very highest peak of COVID is smaller than in a few prior bad flu seasons over the previous 30 years. And it's all there in the graph.
No, absolutely.
I mean, Our problem is a pandemic.
And the converse is all the damage that's done by this fear mongering. So, yes. You know, I didn't bring up, I actually have, I don't know if others have this term, but I kind of thought of this term. I call them ghost babies. And I don't think it's a fitting term. I should probably come up with something better, but it makes me sad to think there are literally hundreds of thousands of children who, never came to be under this fear. So this is a kind of a ghost statistic, and it's a vacuole. It's a thing that's not there. But the numbers of anticipated births went down by about 150,000 in that Zika panic year. And I assume there have been repercussions in the diminished birth rate, which has declined worldwide, but it declined in Brazil as well. And throughout the tropics, you know, this seems to coincide with other interests. And when we get to conspiracy of interests, I do think there are people who, again, I think macabrely and grotesquely and perversely cheer on certain, the potential of a, you know, disfiguring, sad, life, not ending, but life-changing, life-altering abnormality, because it will help further their goals. And so I think that you don't hear the negation. So if the news media and others were completely honest, they would say, we acted in complete best interest, all right? You know, we thought it was there. Like, I can appreciate this. Like, you can ask my wife. I've made mistakes in my life, okay? And the question is what you do about those and whether you acknowledge them or not. And what people really like, they like an apology. Like, you can do almost anything. You say, I'm so sorry. This is what I thought. This is what I saw at the time. And in retrospect, I erred. And fine. People are almost cool with almost anything. Almost whatever. And in this case, you will never see this. Everyone is doubling down on this, you know, fake reality, this kind of Potemkin village of a syndrome. And nobody's backing down. All three legs of this stool not only are wobbly, but they may not even exist. Like Zika, let's assume it exists. Was it ever in Brazil, or were they confusing with dengue? Well, it's for me a distinction without a difference, because either it's a mild dengue and dengue doesn't cause this, or it wasn't there. Whatever. I mean, it just doesn't really matter. And the microcephaly thing, it turns out, probably was, you know, people, I'm not saying they didn't see more cases of microcephaly, fine, but it wasn't statistically washed well enough to be, you know, firm. Everybody jumped the gun. They all didn't wait for science to catch up, and they used the public, you know, mechanism of leaking to make something happen. Yeah. As a result, we have, you know, a missing, you know, set of 150,000 children who don't exist. Presumably families can go through different types of strains and whatnot. And probably there are women who might have microcephalic babies from any of the 30 other, you know, natural, indistinct causes, and they get blamed. You know, what did you do? You went outside. I told you, you know, there's all kinds of other stuff. And then people are still operating under this image. Now, it's not the most horrible thing ever, but it's something we don't need. And so the public health establishment came along and said, you know, we acted in our best interest. We did everything we could to protect you at the time. We thought it was real. But as it turns out, again, check my watch, 8 years later, it doesn't seem to do this. We're going to, like, you know, assume it doesn't. And but what conversely is going to happen, though, this is my conspiracy theory, is what's going to happen is that short enough, soon enough, there will be a Zika vaccine, because it's not impossible. They make a dengue one. It can't be that hard to make a Zika one. And maybe this mRNA or whatever, you can make these things pretty fast, and you get the gene, so forth. It's going to be out there, and it's going to be quasi or fully mandated to 1 billion, you know, young, you know, family age men and women, because they're going to say the men can give it to the women through sex or whatever. And so everybody, and then going to be doing it, a child is doing one more thing to pop in at whatever, $10 a dose, whatever it is, and $10 times 1 billion. Times every, you know, whatever, boosters and the new population. Yeah. I mean, this is a good economic model when you don't only have to make the formula once. So you're going to make this one. And then after that, once the Zika vaccine is there, they're going to say, we fixed this problem. You know, at the time Zika microcephaly came around, if you did the math, and mind you, I did the math, based on the predictions and the penetration rate, which mind you, at its worst, was only about 4 to 8% of microcephalic, of Zika, supposedly Zika infected pregnant women, only 4% of them actually theoretically, according to their best models or their most alarming models, would have gone on to microcephaly. But if you did that number throughout the tropics, you would come out with about 1 million microcephalic babies extra per annum from here to eternity, you know, from going back to 2015 onwards. And this never happened. I mean, thank God it never happened. And thank God it never happened. But you know, people deserve, you know, there was some commercial, you deserve a break today at McDonald's, I think it was. You know, you deserve a break today to know that this one thing, all our heart and soul, we thought it was real. And we're sorry it took this long to really announce it. But this is just one thing we're going to take off the list, and we're going to move on with our lives. And we're always watching out for you. That's what I would do as WHO, you know, public health, you know, voice.
WHO, to be quite honest, Randall, WHO has long been captured. They were complicit in the swine flu scandal, and mainstream actually covered that at the time, Der Spiegel. It was an absolute debacle, in cahoots with pharma to massively exaggerate swine flu, which ended up doing next to nothing in real world terms. And it was all based on pumping at the time the swine flu vaccine. This, all of these things, and we saw in COVID as well, it's literally industry is taking over the space of communicable diseases. They don't care about chronic diseases. They don't want any of those fixed. They don't want any preventative. They just want to throw drugs at chronic disease. And the communicable are even better because you can bring in fear as well. And to your point, it's a license to print money. Because you get an issue that's almost statistically doesn't exist, but you have a line of sight to 1 billion people having to take your drug. What could be better than that? And I'll tell you, nothing. And nothing could be better than that. And at the end of the day, there's no conspiracy theory. There's a conspiracy of interest, sure, confluence of interests, and there's genuine conspiracies where partners get together and various stakeholders, and they're out to game things and make profit. But there's no conspiracy theory, as in, like, you know, aliens. This is business. And unfortunately, we're entering an era now where they are getting away with it, and they're getting more and more influence, not less, as time goes by. I mean, COVID has handed vastly more wealth to the richest and the corporations and pharma and WHO powers. So it ain't going to get any better unless people wake up to this nonsense. I mean, that's the only thing. Unless people wake up and say, hold on a minute, we're getting repeatedly scammed again and again. And unless someone does something, we're just going to end up in a complete clown world.
Yeah. So yeah. I've been this one man band of trying to point out, you know, that Zika was not all there. I think I always like to say Zika is a real virus and Microsoft is a real syndrome. Just A doesn't cause B. So I have a book, Overturning Zika, and it's coming out in Brazil now. I've got some shorter articles for people to read, and maybe we can pop some references in. But I did send, you know, so I've been sending letters out. I compiled 889 email addresses of people who've written on Zika, you know, research, PhDs, MDs, and whatnot. I've gotten back a return rate of less than 1% of my emails to them. And such as they have returned, you know, I pretty much like, you've never seen a case of microcephaly. You don't know how wrenching it is. And mind you, I have seen a case of microcephaly. I do know how wrenching it is. That doesn't, you know, it's neither here nor there, but I don't get any traction within the scientific, the, you know, media, whatever, across the board, just, you know, nobody really seems to latch onto this. There are very few. I mean, I commend Brownstone for publishing my Zika article. The Washington Examiner posted my article about the human challenge trial a year ago, and nothing really happened with that. I sent it to members of Congress. I've sent letters to the Zika, WHO's Zika Emergency Committee. They had the Emergency Committee, you know, in 2016, and, you know, most of them are still alive and whatnot. No responses back. I've sent gobs, that's a technical term. I've sent gobs of letters out. I want people to, you know, pay attention to this and reckon with this. And what I would like is, you know, if RFK Jr., the Children's Defense, I always get it named wrong, but his
own Children's Health Defense. Yeah.
Thank you. Might take an interest in this because this is the next thing happening. It's not going to be, at some point, it's not going to be just the tropics, because they're going to say, you know what, you're born in North Newcastle, but someday you might go to Brazil. You're going to get this vaccine too. It's going to be, you watch, it's going to be the world getting the Zika vaccine, and there's no reason for it. And it, again, potentially, as we've seen with Dengvaxia, the dengue vaccine, it potentially has complications. This is going to be a wash because, you know, somebody used to say, when you don't pay for something online, that's because you are the product.
Exactly. No, I think it's a classic case, and it just shows the biosecurity spook state. And, you know, the pandemic industry is gaining ground. And with mRNA, I had a discussion with a top immunologist in this, and it just hit me like a steam hammer a couple of years ago. mRNA enables profiteering an order of magnitude bigger than I originally thought, because the speed and the low cost and the massive productivity of RNA. You could even, for instance, when you see a new flu of any sort in the East and you know it's seasonally coming to Europe, with RNA you can bang out billions of doses in time for when it comes to Europe. They won't make any difference, they won't help anyone, and they'll probably cause harm. Who cares?
So I'm gonna sound a little bit like a squish on this. I think mRNA technology is potentially, you know, wonderful. And someday it's going to be tailored to very specific things. Like, you know, I don't want to point at you, but, you know, somebody's literal, that guy's pancreatic cancer. And it's going to be very much targeted. They're going to be a cellular thing so that they can make boutique treatment for particular problems. And it's going to be an awesome thing. So I like the idea. I just feel as if the mRNA technology was the wrong thing to do for the entire population. There were certain countries or certain subsets of population that wanted to volunteer for the mRNA. Like Israel was one to be front of the line. They had this special deal with Pfizer. They wanted their whole population immunized and vaccinated over and over again and so forth. Fine. If you want to, you know, do that and the people are on board with it, they could have done that with some small slice and done their population study or even some piece of, you know, a town, whatever. They decided the mRNA was going to supersede everything else and that people should avoid, you know, therapeutics in that prior year and kind of lock people down. It's almost as if, I'm not saying it was because, but it's almost as if, you know, everyone was being kept naive, immunologically naive as much as possible, so they could do that vaccine trial with this new modality. And the J&J, which used the adenovirus one, and the Sinovac and Covaxin and Sputnik and whatnot, which used kind of like what I call freeze-dried, you know, whole virus technique. They just injected that. Those were all, you know, dismissed as less than effective and whatnot, when it really probably didn't matter for the vast majority of the population, which wasn't going to get that sick with the virus anyway, and would get better immunity from catching the virus in the first place. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff. So I think there was a huge push for the mRNA part, and that's all well and good if you had a willing population. If you could get a new Diamond Princess, you know, cruise ship aligned, and you pay everybody, you know, to try the mRNA, and you put them on the cruise ship, and you go out in the ocean, and you watch, see how it goes, and they all make $1,000 either way, and they sign up for it, disclaimer, and they understand the risk, whatever, that's fine. That's not how it was done. It was done with a population that's effectively, almost literally held hostage.
Yeah, of course. And of course, RNA, I have no problem with technology. I'm the opposite of a Luddite. RNA used for its benefits in a targeted fashion. That's nothing to do with this, as you've just described. Basically, I was told by a top immunology guy, said essentially the bottom line is RNA would have taken around 30 years to bring in a large scale. It would be like GMO. People would be worried about it. It would be all kinds of problems. It would take decades to bring in on a wide scale. With a pandemic, you can get it in 6 months. So basically, off the record, here's the opportunity to bring it in 6 months.
All those speed bumps and regulatory aspects.
All gone.
Yeah, all gone. And the FDA, which theoretically was the watchdog, was playing in the sport. So it's kind of like having your referees and umpires, you know, playing the on the soccer pitch.
Yeah, and writing to the Zika department in the WHO, it's like basically, you know, mid last century, it's like writing to Germany's, you know, National Socialist, you know, leaders and saying, you know, it's inappropriate that you entered Poland. I mean, come on. Look who you're writing to.
Yeah, they, but anyway, they would answer back. I have their answer back. They would say, what's Poland?
Yeah, what's Poland?
Wait. There was a country there once. I forget. Oh, never mind.
You know what they'd say nowadays? They'd say, that's a conspiracy theory. That's the Poland conspiracy theory. It's misinformation and disinformation to say it was a country. We're going to censor you off YouTube for that. There we are, Radl. Well, listen, I know we both got hard stops. I think we've covered that story, or you've covered that story excellently. And I think the takeaway is this kind of stuff, we need the people aware, and we need politicians made aware. And it'll be grassroots, because you won't be able to stop the top doing these things. Only grassroots can push back, I reckon.
Well, I thank you for that, and I appreciate being able to, you know, help put the message out, I'm very much honored that you allowed me to use your platform for that.
Oh, not at all. Fascinating story, Randall. And for anyone watching, the links to Randall's book are down below to give the full story. Today, obviously, we had to go through a whistle stop, but a fascinating story and huge, crucial learnings that are very salient to what's going on in the world today, between the viral issue recently and climate stuff and all the biased and interested parties and stakeholders that are pretty much moving our world into a new place, and we need people to step back and oppose it somewhat, at least. Thank you, Randall.
Thank you, Ivor. I appreciate it.
Hope you enjoyed getting fully informed in a really, really important story there, which has huge relevance, obviously, for the events of the past few years and what's going on in the world. So, as always, huge thanks to my Patreon and PayPal supporters, and that's what keeps this show on the road, countering misinformation and disinformation, and getting the proper perspective out there and the root causes behind what's happening in our world today. So huge thanks, and anyone else who can support a little, really appreciate that. My Patreon has vlogs and monthly Zooms for certain tiers, or indeed if you can just give a small donation, it helps keep my investigative journalism and analytical work on track. So thanks so much, everyone.